Aviation's Only Ant, a few minutes with his creator. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Wes Olszewski's Clyde Morris cartoon strip has been evolving for more than 30 years, and is now a regular feature of our website. I thought you might be interested in meeting Wes and getting some of the story behind Clyde. Wes, welcome, and thanks for spending a few minutes with our listeners today.
Oh, it's good to be here. I'm always a slave to Aero News whenever they call.
Well, I won't get into the details of your contract, but I wanted to talk to you because I think that whenever somebody writes a comic strip that gets a wide following, especially within a particular niche like aviation, the readers of that comic strip have an interest in figuring out what was in the background of this person that led them to become the person who creates this stuff. Tell people how Clyde Morris came to be briefly and why he's an ant.
Well, Clyde Morris has his roots, actually, in model rocketry. When I was a kid, and we're talking age 12 up to the time I went to college at age 19, I was really into model rockets, and I loved to put ants on board to shoot them up. I used to call them astronauts. And, of course, I always tinkered with my rockets and didn't build them by the instructions, and so I had a lot of catastrophic failures. And I found that it was real fun to draw cartoons and spoof my own rocket failures. And, of course, there was always an ant on board. And then when I was in high school, I started sending these little cartoon ants on adventures, undersea adventures and airplane adventures, most of which you can find on the website, ClydeMorris.com. Did I mention that? Oh, anyway.
Yes.
And so when I went away to college, I had an entire portfolio full of these stupid cartoon strips that I had drawn in my high school and junior high school years. And I proceeded to decorate our dorm room my first semester of college with some single-frame cartoons. And one of the guys that lived next door to me, a guy named Dan Karger, we call him Dan the Man, he was on the newspaper staff at Embry-Riddle. And he suggested that I should bring my portfolio of these cartoons back with me after Christmas vacation so we could take them up to the newspaper office. And that's what I did. And I didn't think anybody would even want to read the darn things. And it turned out that they really did want to put them into the student newspaper. So, of course, the lead character had to be an ant because that's what I was used to drawing. And Charles Schulz has a cute little dog, so where is this college kid going to get his lead character? It's going to come from an ant. The first cartoon strip was due on a Monday, and I didn't have a name for the character. And I had gone through all these different names from all the guys in the dorm. We're coming up, and when I say guys, that's not me being sexist. Embry-Riddle was almost 100% male in those days.
Right, right.
Anyway, a lot of the guys in the dorms were coming in with these names from aviation and, you know, the Wright this or the Wilbur that, and nothing was working. It just wasn't working. And as the cartoonist, I'd look at the frame, and it just wasn't working. If you look at that first cartoon strip, which is on the website, you'll see that it's very clear that in those first, there were three strips in that first one. And in the middle one where the character is named, you can see almost where the blank spot was, where I hadn't penned in the name yet. I was on the bus on my way from our off-campus dorm to the main campus to turn in this cartoon strip. And when I was racking my brain over the name, and when the bus turned onto Clyde Morris Boulevard, which runs right across the front of the campus, I looked at the street sign, and I went, "That's the name." And I changed the C to a K, and I penned it in right there on the bus, took the cartoon strip in. It was published. It came out 2 days later on a Wednesday, and the rest is history.
Well, and the fact that you were at Embry-Riddle meant that all your readers it immediately would identify with that character by knowing that street.
Well, not only by knowing that street, but also it turns out that the ant, the little tiny guy, little itty-bitty microscopic person that the whole world is bigger than, was something that everybody could relate to there, because it was a big university even then. And you felt as a freshman, and there was a lot of freshmen on that campus that semester, you felt like you were that little ant. You were the little guy, and there was this big towering world around you that you had to constantly fight against. And that's what Clive Morris has always gone up against.
Well, let me back up a little bit, because there's a story behind why you wound up at Embry-Riddle University, and I think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I come from a working-class family and grew up on the wrong side of the Saginaw River in Saginaw, Michigan, where what you do is you grow up and maybe you graduate from high school, and then you would then in the 70s go off and join the UAW and go to work in the auto plant or in some industry that was related around that. My dad was a 35-year railroad engineer, and he also was the world's best Zamboni driver. And so I grew up in this working class environment, and that's what we were all supposed to do. And I couldn't see it. I wasn't going to do that. So I had an interest in things that flew, because I had an interest in rocketry and the space program. And I was in the Civil Air Patrol. I liked airplanes. And I decided that I wanted to break away from that, that I wanted to break away from that industry and that blue-collar lifestyle. And so I decided to go off to Embry-Riddle. And frankly, everybody that I knew outside of my dad told me I couldn't do it. You can't do this. It's, people like us don't do things like this. People like us don't go to those places.
Right.
You don't have the money. Nobody's rich enough. And so I had to work my way through school, but I did it. And I got out of the what turned out to be the Rust Belt. Mm-hmm. And I don't have anything against people who want to work for a living in a factory. That's fine. It just wasn't for me.
Right. Well, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and a lot of that same thing applied there. I mean, people either went to work for Bethlehem or Republic Steel or at one of the General Motors plants, later for some of the small aerospace companies in the area. But my entire generation left town, pretty much.
Yeah. Same thing in Saginaw, Michigan. A lot of the people that I knew as a teenager bolted out of town. Some of them just because the auto plants were closing. And frankly, they took Gray Iron Foundry and they bulldozed it and planted grass.
Right.
I mean, that tells you something about where that industry is going in that area. And I even had cousins who had to go to places like Shreveport, Louisiana, to keep their jobs because they were senior at GM.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of things change, and I just wanted to be different. I didn't want to be in that crowd that's going to go to work in, quote, the shop. So I didn't.
But you didn't take the career path that a lot of Embry-Riddle grads take either.
No, not really, because my intention when I left for Embry-Riddle, I essentially left everything behind. I had another path that was leading me toward becoming a professional hockey player. I left that behind. I left my family behind. Not that I'm estranged from them, but, you know, I left home. And I left my girlfriend behind, never saw her again, and went off to Daytona Beach, Florida from Saginaw, Michigan, to do this wild thing of flying airplanes. But my intention was not to go all the way through school, become an airline pilot for one of the big airlines, and sit in the cockpit till I turn 65 and some bankruptcy court takes away my pension. That's not what I wanted to do with my life.
Although, in all fairness, it was kind of hard to foresee at that point that that's the way it would go for her.
Yeah, that is true, but that wasn't my end goal. My end goal was to go to Embry-Riddle and finish. That was my goal, was to graduate, to finish, to get it done, to not quit. And I think that goes back to my working-class heritage, is you don't quit. You always keep going. And that was the one thing I always kept telling myself as I worked my way through college, is you can't quit.
Although, in all fairness, Wes, it could be said that you did make a career out of finishing Embry-Riddle.
Well, you know, I've actually heard that. You know, and as I went through the process of working my way through college, which people don't understand, they use the term professional student a lot. And that's, a professional student makes money and a living from being in school. I wasn't in school.
Right.
Most of the time I was across the street at the Kmart store filling counters and working in the garden shop, or I was at one of the hotels working as a security person, busting heads during spring break, or I was mopping hangar floors back in Saginaw, Michigan, and, you know, living at my parents' house for a couple of years at a time to make enough money to get back in and keep going. And it was almost an obsession with me to finish, just to finish.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit in the interest of time. You spent on and off 10 years at Embry-Riddle, and then you had eventually accumulated a total of 5,000 hours, and you say not one of those hours has been pleasure flying.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. Yes, I was, let's say, associated with the university for a year because I was in and out, more out than in for 10 years. And then after I got out, I went the standard route that a lot of people go is flight instructor and then regional airline furlough, another regional airline captain, a major airline, realize you're in purgatory, and then I went corporate and did that for 3 years. And so that's the direction that I basically went in. But when I got to Embry-Riddle, the first thing they told us during our orientation is, this is your job. You're a professional now. You're not here for hobby flying. You're not here for fun flying. You are here to be a professional aviator, and you better start thinking that way right now. You better start treating this as your job. And I took that seriously when I heard that. And like I said, coming from a working class background, that's the way I saw it, is that's my job. And that really became ingrained in me. And the result is that I don't pleasure fly. I'm not a pleasure flyer. God bless people that are, and I hope they really like it. I went to school at Embry-Riddle with people who they went to school and they flew all day, and then or they went in the military and they flew, and at every waking hour they spent flying other things just for fun. But I'm not that way. For me, this is a job. Flying is a job, and every time I get into a cockpit, even if I got into one today, I would be at work. And that's just the way I see it. And some people think that's odd. I don't. I've always seen flying as my job.
Well, Clyde Morris obviously got under the skin of a few people at Embry-Riddle from time to time, but it also gained you kind of a special standing among the administration there that kind of surprised you.
Well, yeah, it did, because what happened was, first of all, I was a second semester freshman when the cartoon strip hit. You never expect something to become a hit, especially when you're in that environment. I was just struggling to get the next class done. And doing the cartoon strip once a week, three strips a week, I didn't think anybody was even really reading it. And as I can tell you right now, as an author with, 12 books under my belt, you get to the point where you start writing stuff and you really don't think about people out there reading it. And that was the same thing with Clyde Morris. I didn't realize that there were people out there that were reading it and liking it. And I tell the story that when the first strip came out, I sat in class and watched people reading the Avion newspaper and just thumbing right past it without paying any attention.
Right.
And then that same night of that first strip, I got off the bus to go eat dinner, and there was my cartoon strip laying in the gutter. It had been raining, and it was a cartoon up, and the guy in front of me stepped on it. So I really thought that this was going to go nowhere, and I was convinced that, what a guy like me, what am I going to do with a cartoon strip like this?
Early lessons in humility make us thankful when it happens for us later on.
Yes, that's true. And what I didn't know was that the administrators had gotten to the point where they would joke that you hadn't made it as an administrator at the university until you had been in Clyde Morris. And that's something I didn't hear until very late on in doing the cartoon strip. But there was this underswelling of popularity with the cartoon strip that I really didn't give much consideration to for several years.
We're talking with Wes Olszewski, who does the Clyde Morris comic strips that you can see not only on Aero News, but also at ClydeMorris.com. And that's Clyde spelled with a K. And we'll be back with more of this Aero News special feature in just a moment. This AeroCast is brought to you by Aircraft Engine Services, makers of the aluminum V220 and V300T engines.
How up to date is your aircraft engine? Automotive engineering has advanced so much over the past 30 years that you almost never have to raise the hood. Why can't an airplane engine be just as simple and just as reliable? Now it can. Check out the new V220 and V300T from Aircraft Engine Services. The all-aluminum construction of the V220 and V300T gives these engines the best power-to-weight ratio in their class. Earlier aluminum block engines suffered from excessive wear unless they were protected with heavy steel cylinder liners. In the V220 and V300T, each cylinder bore is surface-coated with Nicosil, an electro-deposited nickel coating containing hard silicone carbide particles. The benefits of a better power-to-weight ratio include increased range and higher useful loads, with less of a trade-off between fuel capacity and passenger or cargo carrying capacity. The AES V220 and V300T, as simple as a car's engine, but oh so much more fun to drive. Check us out on the web at VAircraftEngine.com or call us at 321-268-3718. Aircraft Engine Services, the shape of things to come.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR22 GTS, Cirrus's premium luxury ride that has come to define Cirrus aircraft as one of the world's elite. Every dream option from supple leather seats to an exhilarating 310 horsepower performance and speed come standard, giving new meaning to the phrase fully loaded. When flying the SR22 GTS, getting there is truly more than half the fun. To learn more, call 888-750-9000 9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design. Clarity Aloft headsets employ patented Comply Canal tips composed of soft viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. More than simple earplugs, these foam tips provide full-spectrum noise reduction and outstanding attenuation. This advanced technology is lab-tested, proving that viscoelastic passive noise reduction is superior to active noise reduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plagg. My guest is Wes Olszewski, who does the Clyde Morris comic strips that you see. Wes, let me stop here for a minute. Is it disrespectful to call it a comic strip?
No, it's just fine.
Because I know comic books now like to be referred to as graphic novels.
No. I'm not that hoity-toity about what I do. It's essentially, this is a little character that I draw on the computer, and I put funny words into his mouth, you know, so... I have absolutely no highbrow about it at all. You can call it a comic strip. You can call it whatever you want.
All right. So Clyde Morris, who is aviation's only aunt, can be read on Aero News and also at ClydeMorris.com, where you'll find extensive archives. And that's Clyde Morris with a K. Let me ask you, because one of the things that I think people think would be the hardest about doing a comic strip or any kind of serial comedy work would be finding inspiration. Now, I know the answer to this because I found that as I get older, more things strike me as funny or inspirational for some bit or some piece of writing than they did when I was young. You have found yourself immersed in an industry which is a font of comedy.
Well, this is true, and I often say that the cartoon strip writes itself. For example, tonight... I have a deadline tonight, and I haven't even sat down and started the cartoon strip yet because it'll just come to me. But I've always been lucky that always happens. Even through college, that always happened. The cartoon strip would just come to me. And it does. It writes itself most of the time. And when it doesn't, I have some fallbacks that I won't elaborate on, but you know, I have some fallbacks that I can use. And also, though, as former airline captain and, you know, ATP and all that kind of stuff, and having done from the CFI to the regional airlines to the major airlines to corporate, I really have kind of seen a lot of it. And there are times when all you have to have is good sense to realize how stupid some of the stuff is that goes on. And then that's my job, is to shine a nice bright light on the stupid. And when I do that, the cartoon strip works every time.
Well, and not only that, but having done Clyde at Embry-Riddle for 10 years, you obviously developed an instinct for focusing on politically ridiculous things.
Well, yeah, I like to say that I got a bachelor's degree in aeronautical science, but I got a PhD in editorial cartooning. Because what you're doing at a university like that, especially one that has such a tight group and is so focused on the industry that they work with, is you're always performing without a net in front of the steepest critics that you can think of. Because these are people who are supposed to be teaching the guy who drew the strip about what goes on in the industry. And so, therefore, I had to focus on what goes on in the university, too. And now I've gotten to the point where I have enough experience in the industry that I can focus on what goes on in the industry. But I get a lot of help. I have a lot of readers out there who are longtime Clyde fans that go way back to the 70s, who are now in positions at major corporations and major airlines and aerospace industry corporations, and they feed me a lot of really good stuff.
Well, but on the other hand, so does Aero News. If I just run down the list of some things I've seen become inspirations in your work in the past few weeks, I see things like user fees. Is this not a bottomless pit of amusement?
Oh, it's absolutely a bottomless pit of amusement, and it's an important issue. It's an important topic that I think you really have to bring to light to Aero News readers. A cartoon strip does that. A cartoon strip really takes what could be an overlooked headline or overlooked issue, and it explodes it right into your eyes. It says, "This is where this is," and I give you a twisted point of view of it. Either it could really go this way, or it's coming this way. And fortunately, I've been very lucky. Normally, I shoot from the hip and hit the target every time. Mm-hmm. That's not too hard with user fees. It's a pretty big target.
Well, yeah, and I think that it kind of ties in, at least in my mind, it ties into the huge gaffes that airline management has committed just running their own businesses in the past few months.
Well, or running their own businesses into the ground in the last few years. There was not too long ago that Northwest Airlines was making so much money they couldn't hide it. And then all of a sudden along comes 9/11, and as I like to say in the cartoon strip, they went out and filed Chapter 9/11.
Right.
Which
right.
is just a nice excuse for, oh, this is a good way for us to get out from under our how many years of bad management.
Tell me about the JetBlue thing. That has been JetBlue has been the butt of late night TV jokes now for a week or so. Hey, is that fair?
Well, it is and it isn't. JetBlue has always tried to portray themselves as, and this is my opinion because I'm an opinion guy, as being different, as being and not as stupid as other airlines. And I actually have a little personal experience with JetBlue right when they started. I found out immediately they were just as stupid as everybody else. But they've really gone a long way to try and not do those types of things. Now what they've done with their Bill of Rights is essentially they've taken the legs out from underneath a lot of politicians that were going to try to pass something official like that. And we all know that, a camel is a horse designed by politicians.
Right.
And if they came up with a set of rules that they want passengers who are disgruntled or distressed to be able to rely on from airlines, you're going to get a camel. You're going to get something really nasty. And a good example of that in history is the Volstead Act. Anybody knows what the Volstead Act is? Yeah, that's the act that said what? It set up prohibition. Mm-hmm. And if you ask anybody, they'll say, well, it said you couldn't drink. No, that's not what it said. That's what the people that did prohibition wanted. That's not what it said. When the Congress got done with it, it said you couldn't manufacture, you couldn't transport, and you couldn't sell alcohol. Didn't say you couldn't drink.
Right.
You could drink until you died, and it would be legal under the Volstead Act. And that's what would happen with a passenger bill of rights. You'd have another Volstead Act.
Well, even the tax code is set up to make it appear to low-income people like the government socking it to the rich, and then provides loopholes so that the rich, who actually fund the campaigns the next time those folks want to get back in office, still get their tax breaks. There's so many things pulling in different directions in Washington.
Well, Washington is, I live right outside of Washington, D.C. You know, if the wind shifts, sometimes the stench blows over to my house. And the thing with Washington, D.C. and a lot of things in our society, it's a good example is the lottery. Mm-hmm. The lottery is set up to make regular folks think they can get rich easy, and you can't. I'm sorry, you can't, okay? Do the math. A lot of things are set up that way, and there's really not a lot you can do in our society about that other than get smart. And that's part of what Clyde Morris is about. I try to take a what would be a normally bypassed or overlooked or easily overlooked issue, I try to make it so big and so funny and so comical that you start thinking about, well, wait a minute now. And that's when I've done my job.
Now, did you get preempted a little bit in your ridicule of Nancy Pelosi when the Republicans dubbed her plane Pelosi One? I thought that was one of the funniest lines of the year.
I wish I had written it. I got a chance to use it, but I wish I had written it. And no, but I do admit that I was the first one to give her a C-130, which she richly deserves.
Well, yeah, the acoustics are bad inside, but whatever.
Oh, yeah, well, that's what those little yellow marshmallows are for.
Yeah.
So three of my better cartoon strips so far this year. And thank you, Nancy Pelosi, for that. But I try to be an equal politician jabber, you know, so... I have no political affiliation. I'm sorry, if you look at my voter registration for the state of Maryland, it says no political affiliation because I'm an editorial cartoonist, and I don't think ethically I should have a political affiliation. I should be able to tease everybody.
Let me ask you about something that's been an aviation joke or an aerospace joke for the last couple of weeks, and let me get your take on it, because... some people think it went way too far, and that's what happened to Lisa Nowak, the astronaut who donned the diaper and the trench coat and the wig and dot, dot, dot. I mean, obviously a source of humor material, but has that been past the point of being constructive?
Well, it's past the point of something that I would want to use tastefully, because I think that there's something really, really wrong there, and I'll tell you why I say that. Lisa Nowak is a Naval Academy graduate. She is a military professional. She is a professional astronaut. These people think in a way that is very goal-oriented, and if you set out to do something, you will accomplish it. That's all there is to it. Bing, bang, boom, and you do it. If she wanted to kill the other person, that lady would be dead, and we'd be talking about a mysterious death of an Air Force person in a parking lot in Orlando. We would not be talking about a plot that looks like it was put together by a jilted high school girl.
Right.
Or high school guy, either way. And so what that tells me is, and I spent some time putting handcuffs on people in earlier careers, something's not right. The pieces don't fit. These pieces don't fit. And I'm really thinking that Lisa Nowak, I hope now, will get some help because she needs it. And this is a tragic thing, and I know she's in the hands of really loving people right now, and she's going to need some help. And we're all human, and even though some of us are cartoonists and authors and others are big-time icons such as astronauts, which make authors and cartoonists look like nothing, we're still human. We still are all made up out of the same stuff, and they say in law enforcement that you, with people, you always start out at the same level when you go out on a call or you're answering something, and you stand in front of a person, you have a very big animal in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you start. You have a big animal in front of you. Now, is this animal going to behave like a human, or is it going to behave like an animal? And that's, you kind of go from there. And we're all kind of the same stuff. We all have our breaking points. Nobody at NASA has a big S underneath their regular clothes.
Right.
And so these are, even though we want to think of them as super people, they are not. And they shouldn't have to be super people. That should have gone out with the original seven. And I really hope that Lisa Nowak can get some help. And I'm glad that the news went elsewhere.
Right.
To other issues, and can leave this good person to recover. And I think personally that they piled on a lot of charges then in Orlando, and I think this is going to work out eventually. But it's not something that I would go after as a cartoonist, because I don't think it's funny. I really don't think it's funny.
Yeah.
And I don't think that anything I could draw or write would help the situation at all for either NASA or for people on the outside. And it would be too cheap to go after. So the consequence of that is just stay away from it.
Now, I'm going to ask you about, we're running low on time, but I do want to ask you about one more bottomless pit of entertainment value, and that is the Transportation Security Administration. And you recently got a little bit out of the aviation realm and got into their overreaction in Boston to the Cartoon Network promotion.
Yeah, well, the TSA, as with Homeland Security, 9/11, in my opinion, allowed a lot of people and a lot of groups to go for power that they couldn't get by other means, i.e. the election booth or the Congress in general. They went after power. They're consolidating power. And a lot of that comes through taking away liberty. Whenever somebody goes after power, they got to take away your liberty, or at least some form of it. And TSA could have done really good things. Homeland Security could do really good things. But, man, you have to watch them like a hawk, because absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I believe that with all my heart, that that's what happens. You have to watch these people. We have to be watchdog. And when TSA got to the point where they said, well, even the Congress doesn't have any jurisdiction over us, wait a minute,
yeah.
Then who does?
Yeah.
And that's when I started going after them. I did not make a lot of friends at TSA. I even had one very high up person say that he wanted my head on a pike in his office.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get it, so he's subsequently gone to another job. But
well, and you know, talk about proving the point.
Well, it does, and now there are good people at TSA. They have a really hard, monotonous job that they have to do, and passengers are, well, stupid for the most part. And they do stupid stuff. Now, people who are frequent flyers will stand in line and they'll see this stuff and they go, oh, not again. People who work for the airlines will see this stuff. Oh, not again. People like me, I go to the airport terminal. I keep all my metal, my watches, and everything else in my carry-on bag. It goes through and I put it on the other side and I don't have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if they ask me for additional screening, I cooperate. I give my additional screening and off we go. But what I'm really concerned with TSA and DHS is, it's like the movie Taps, where the army guy told his kid that, you know, they were holding a little fort that was their school, and he said, you've got all of your power nose to nose with the cops and your flanks are exposed. And that's what is going on with DHS and TSA, is they got most of their effort directed toward the people coming through those arches and their flanks are exposed. And you can go by a lot of major airports and take a look and go, I could drive a truck right through there.
Right.
And the other problem that I have is the T in TSA means transportation. And as far as I've seen, after 9/11, most terrorist bombings and other acts like that haven't taken place on aircraft.
Nope. Nope. We have to screen people getting into Honda Civics. That's the real deal.
Honda Civics or rental vans or whatever. If you want to do it, then you better do it. But they really can't, because then that kind of goes a step too far. Now, instead of just hitting us in aviation and taking away our liberties, now you're taking away even more liberties, and that might take away their power. So it all comes down to the conflict theory of sociology. You know, people who have power want to keep it, and people who don't have power want to get it. And if you have to get it through something like 9/11 and go, well, we should come up with this, this, and this. I remember right after 9/11, what did they want to do? They wanted to stop us from being able to sell model rockets, for crying out loud.
Right, right.
Little tiny Estes model rockets. They didn't want you to ship those. You know, ATF said that, and ATF is still after the model rocket industry.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that, why? Well, it's because of 9/11 and terrorism. Well, wait a minute. I'm an American citizen. I'm not a terrorist. Just because I fly, I'm not a terrorist. Because I have model rockets, I'm not a terrorist. And that's where common sense has to come in. And when you have nothing but written procedures that you will follow blindly, you lose common sense. And when you lose common sense, you're going to lose liberty.
Wes Olszewski is the creator of the Clyde Morris cartoon strip, which has been around now for more than 30 years. You'll find it on our website at aeronews.net. And you'll also find extensive archives and the whole story behind Clyde at ClydeMorris.com. And it's Clyde spelled with a K. Wes, we really appreciate you taking some time out. We want to do this again sometime.
Hey, you got my number. You know where I'm at.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aeronews. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.